passing it around. Okay, yeah.
Hi, this is Swan, and you're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. This week I'm here with musician Bo Thayer, who, Vermont native? No, you're from...
Oh, I'm from Massachusetts.
Massachusetts.
They call us massholes up here.
Masshole native. Now you live in Vermont. You've been here for a long time. This is home.
This is home. I've been here about 20 years now.
And playing music the whole time?
Yep.
Yep.
Amongst other things.
Other projects fill in the gaps.
Many, many projects, and many of them musical projects as well.
And much touring, much festivals. You have kind of your busy season coming up the summer, right?
Yeah, all the time is a busy season for me. It just depends. It just doesn't seem to end.
Yeah.
But there's, it just keeps on going, and sometimes the winter is more busy than summer, and, but yeah, this weekend is about to be a busy weekend for me. You know, there's no rhyme or reason to it. It just, just kind of really just go with the flow up here.
Yeah, and to give some context, what town is this?
Well, this is the town of Gaysville, which is a hamlet to the town of Stockbridge. Gaysville only has about 90 people in it, and it's got a rich history. It used to be a fairly large community of over 2,000 people, but it was taken out in a flood of 1927, and then it kind of came back. You know, there used to be like a button factory here and a lumber yard.
And the White River flooded?
Yeah, and the White River flooded, and the dam broke, and the town was built below the dam, and so goodbye to that Gaysville, and it kind of came back as a touristy place. People have hunting cabins up here. There's there's the Killington Ski Resort is about...
It's close.
It's pretty close, about 20 miles south of here, and a lot of hunting cabins, and there's a campground, and people come up here and fish and enjoy the White River and all that stuff. So it kind of came back as a little summer tourist place, and to a certain extent, the winter tourist place too.
Now home. And looking out your window, yeah. I had to drive up to get here, so we're on a hill a little bit.
Yeah, we're overlooking the Delectable Mountain Range and the White River Valley.
And trees and rain are
trees
happening outside.
Yeah.
So maybe you can even hear the rain if we're quiet. I don't know.
And, but it's beautiful up here. But we're a tad isolated.
And this is your studio, by the way.
Yeah, we're in my studio right now.
Enough to let us record here.
Big work in progress. When I first moved here, it was a little tiny cabin. I moved up from Boston because my girlfriend at the time was pregnant, and we were about to have a baby, and we found this place. And
this is your son who's going to college now.
Yep. And he's about to start his freshman year of college. And so we found this little tiny cabin that I bought for next to nothing.
Uh-huh.
And it needed a lot of work, and it was all overgrown, hemlock trees everywhere, and... So I just started fixing the joint up, and...
Is that the original structure, then, your house?
The house over here is that's part of the original structure. Did a lot of work to that over the years as well, but the studio here is built out of the trees that once stood on the property. You just chopped them down, and I had them milled up by a local sawyer, and, just...
And
framed it traditionally. It's all, there's not a nail in it, really. It's all, mortise and tenon and peg, like a traditional timber frame. And it took a long time, but it was only way I could really do it is because I didn't have a lot of help and I didn't have any money. So it's the kind of thing where I can just make a little area to work by myself as I could. There was playing music and gigs and trying to tour as much as possible. And, when I had time, I'd come up and just with chisels and saws and stuff and
slow
just start.
Slow and steady?
Yeah, slow and steady. And it's the kind of.
I'll have to take some pictures because it is incredibly beautiful. And I'm sure anyone who is interested in architecture would appreciate the details.
I had some. I mean, my dad is an architect. My brother. I'm from a line of architects. You were asking from a musical background.
Yeah.
My dad does play trumpet, but
family
he's,
wasn't really musical.
He's not really. No.
So when did you pick up a guitar? I'm guessing was
yeah,
your first
I picked up a guitar.
Instrument.
You know what? I'm gonna pause this one. Make sure I turn that phone off. How's that sound? All right. So. The phone has been muted.
We might edit that out. So, we were talking about your family, and
yeah,
your
so
father
my,
played the trumpet.
My dad still does play the trumpet in a little kind of a brass band down in Massachusetts. And my brother picked up banjo around the same time that I picked up guitar, and which was probably age of 12 or so. And my grandmother bought me my first guitar, which I still have, which is a Yamaha Dreadnought acoustic guitar, and just took off from there. You know, I knew instantly that's what I wanted to do. There was never any doubt that I was gonna pursue music, and ended up just being more of a songwriter than a real hotshot guitar player. And
well, you've also created your own instruments and modified instruments.
Oh,
so.
Yeah, we can go there. There's a lot. Yeah.
So I would say that you understand enough about a guitar.
Yeah, I mean, over the years, I just, you know, this was back when I first started playing. It was late 70s, early 80s. I was in junior high school and, you know, started a band, started playing all the classic hit stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Listening.
Like who? Draw some
names. Oh, geez. You know, the obvious stuff. Bob Dylan, Neil Young, the Rolling Stones, Grateful Dead, all that stuff.
The classics.
You know, the
but
classics,
I just wanted
you know,
to throw
who
some names
and the
out.
The Beatles
yeah,
and the
yeah.
Beach Boys, everything.
All the hit songs.
And, you know, and it was cool because it was my own thing. My parents weren't, they were pretty academic people. My dad being an architect and my mom being a librarian, and my mom was a librarian at the local library, which had access to all the records. So that's
Ooh.
How I got to really start getting in deep, because you know
that was your education.
That was my education. I didn't have much money to go to record stores and buy stuff, and we'd listen to the radio and stuff like that, but really, I went to the library and just
Which I think
spent
is a
hours and hours and hours.
A wonderful time to plug local libraries. I mean, that was my story too. I just would,
yeah.
I would actually skip school and then hide in the library and read books. But
yep. Well, you get along with
sanctuary of knowledge.
You get along with Marion, who's my mom. She's a librarian. Her name is Marion. It's true.
Wow, that's wonderful.
And she's still, you know, she still is a librarian. She works at a charter school.
I think maybe if you're
70s.
Marion, you have to be a librarian.
Yeah, it's kind of...
It's like a rule.
Yep. So it was really cool because I just spent hours just perusing these racks and racks and racks of records. And I was able to take out as many as I wanted to and bring them home and decide what I liked. And so that was kind of like my musical education. And I took some guitar lessons.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, you know, it was just exploring on my own. I didn't have any real heavy influence from a family member about
how to do it
or what to listen
or
to.
Or what's entailed. It was, but I think you obviously have the passion, which is the key component to driving any trajectory.
That is for sure. And I still do. I mean, and it hasn't been easy. I mean, who the hell moves up to Vermont to forward their music career? It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But you know, I really never was too interested in becoming like a kind of a rock star figure or anything like that, or successful in that way. But I did want to write. I wanted to write my own way and find my own path and find my own methods. And I found that, you know, just living, I'm bumping ahead up now to like when I was living in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And this is after, you know, years of being on the road with, like, a punk rock band.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe mention the bands you formed
dissolved
or no.
Junior high school, I was in, you know, a cover band. We played all the classic stuff. And then
mm-hmm.
high school, started writing our own stuff a little bit. And, let me see. And then, yeah, I guess once I got to, I decided I was going to go to music school.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and took a little, a couple choruses in a, I think it was a summer semester at the Boston New England Conservatory of Music in Boston. And
And how did that go?
Oh, I hated it. It was awful.
Why am I not surprised?
I went in there and they had, you know, transpose this and play like this, and no, you're going to learn this stuff. And I just wanted to be creative. I wanted to make art.
Play.
I didn't want to rehash stuff. I was completely bored, and I didn't, you know, I didn't like the way that I was being taught. So I was like, oh crap, what am I going to do now? And so I've always been interested in all kinds of art forms, and I was, you know, also painted and did sculpture, and
I think
And so I reapplied to all these colleges kind of threw together a visual portfolio and ended up going up to Syracuse University, and I went up there and I decided I didn't want to go to college like that either.
This is what I was gonna say. I think this is like, in terms of the creative field, I feel like there's this dichotomy that happens in your career where you either go to a school to get legitimized to create art, or mm-hmm. you go against that and you just start creating and you learn through trial and error. So
absolutely. And my folks, like I said, they're pretty academic oriented. You know, my dad was at like MIT and Amherst College, and
mm-hmm.
he went to the RISD School of Design. So
were they supportive?
Yeah, for the most part, they were.
That's cool.
All kind of the whole time thinking, oh, it's a fad, it'll grow out of it, he'll see how that you won't make any money, and it'll be like, you know, it's a problem. The problem will fix itself.
Supportive, but waiting to see what would come after.
Yeah, and so, but they were adamant about me going to college, which I tried Syracuse, it sucked, I left, and ended up going to a very small art school in Boston, which was pretty cool. You know, I ended up getting like a degree in painting and printmaking and sculpture.
Yeah, I was going to say, what was your
You know,
emphasis?
So I got something to fall back on for, you know. For
yeah, because
can
painting,
fall back on my abstract painting.
Painting is much more secure a career than being a musician.
So right after college, I just jumped in the van with a kind of a alternative post-punk band.
Mm-hmm.
Played kind of...
I was going to say, that's the era of punk.
Yeah, it was. This was now we're... This is 1990. And I had taken a year off, too, and so I was, in the van with five other guys, and we were kind of a band called Seven League Boots, and we were playing shows with bands like, well, we were on the road for a little while with the Fugazi, some people might remember them, and the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones. We were kind of lumped into this ska thing, but also this kind of this punk rock thing. We played kind of like reggae beats. Dub was a big heavy influence, the dub reggae stuff, you know, pre-dance hall reggae stuff was a big influence on us, but so wasn't Led Zeppelin and so wasn't, you know, some of the more punk rock bands. I always remember really being into bands like the Meat Puppets and some of that, you know, some of the cowpunk stuff that was happening then.
Wait,
and,
cowpunk?
Well, you know, there's...
That's a thing?
It was. It kind of, I kind of found that as we were in the Midwest. We played a lot of all-ages shows, which was cool. And this is, like, way before, you know, the internet and cell phones and junk. So there's, like, kind of a network across the country of mostly kids putting on all-ages shows and, you know, and flyering, and there is...
Mm-hmm.
Just I don't even really, looking back, it's like, it's amazing how the communication even happened. But it did, you know, you'd roll into town and you'd see your poster. You'd see your poster on a tree or in a mailbox or something. You're like, all right, these kids are doing their homework. And, you know, we'd go and play these mostly all ages shows. And, you know, there's just so many bands. And there was like this kind of thing happening with country music being sped up a lot more so than, you know, like, you know, that's happened a couple times, and, you know, hillbilly music became bluegrass, and that's a whole different thing. But, you know, and, you know, what eventually led me to, when I finally got back to Boston after being on the road for a few years, you know, the Uncle Tupelo was in town making a record, the No Depression record, and that really hit me hard. And that's when I started getting into songwriting. and not just being, you know, throwing guitar riffs around.
So cowpunk is...
Well, that was just one of the
like
you know,
genre,
it was a genre. You know, there was
a very fast,
now,
loud, music.
Yeah, it kind of, you know, I guess the earlier Uncle Tupelo stuff was, I guess you could call it cowpunk, but you know, there is maybe some of the early Meat Puppet stuff and.
Okay. I've never heard that term before, and I don't claim to know that much about music and history, but.
Oh, maybe the Dead Milkmen, were they cowpunk? There's a, you know, bands that I forget the names, but
yeah.
Just, you know,
it's a
these
thing.
It was like kids like, you know, like with boots on and, you know, flannel shirts and playing loud and heavy, but it was kind of you know, and there's and then it kind of turned into that grunge stuff, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean,
okay,
from
so,
my perspective.
So, out of college, straight into touring with five people, four other people.
Yeah, we were living like dogs too. We, you know, you get paid $50 a show.
Enough gas
and steal,
to get to the next show, maybe.
We'd you know, siphon gas and steal food from the big, you know, big chains,
big companies,
big companies, and we were all proud of ourselves for, you know, I never got quite into the dumpster diving, but you know, a lot of people in that scene were doing stuff like that.
Yeah,
and,
I mean, partially to get by and partially to push against the system, perhaps.
Yeah, and there was a lot of that, but it was fun, and we were young and stupid, and you know, so eventually that burned out, and I just got a little bit more into the writing thing, and you know, moved back to Boston and hung out there, and was in several other bands, and you know, and that's when I decided to get the hell out, and I.
Yeah.
You know, I think I belong in the country. You know, I really had a hard time. I struggled being,
yeah.
You know, and amongst all
so
the pavement.
Yes, and pavement.
And the hustle and bustle. I need grass and dirt under my feet, I suppose.
That definitely resonates with me.
And so, like, once I moved up here, it's funny. I decided I was going to pick up the banjo. And, I stole my brother's banjo that he had kind of given up on,
mm-hmm.
and I just went right at it, 8 hours a day playing banjo, and it started kind of a non-traditional bluegrass band called Benders, and we got pretty popular around here, as well as in Boston,
mm-hmm.
and I remember having a weekly residency, so I was back and forth a lot, and this is, you know, with a 1-year-old kid, and, you know, of course... With all of this, it was kind of hectic, and that relationship dissolved, and that's a whole another chapter. But anyway, the musical aspect that went forward, and yeah, just kept on going. And I decided I needed a studio, and I really wanted to just keep playing, keep writing, and that's when one day I just went out in the backyard with a shovel and started digging a hole, and. That's how the basement
here.
Came into the studio, and 15 years later, here you are. You know, I finally got a place, and...
Is this mostly your art hanging around and about? I'm curious.
Some of it is.
Some of it?
But, yeah, like my son made that kind of Jackson Pollock-esque
mm-hmm.
painting, and, you know, I made the light fixture out of this kick drum here, and...
It's a cool light.
Yeah,
just making things. So
yeah,
let's talk
things.
About modifying an instrument. When was
okay,
that?
Okay, so
when
yeah,
did you
so
decide
then I,
to do that?
So then I guess I started getting bored. After I had, you know, I guess it, looking back, it was always about pushing the envelope with tradition. And, you know, even with the punk rock stuff, a lot of the punk rock kids didn't like us because we were fusing in this dub reggae stuff. And they loved the ska stuff, it seemed. As soon as we slowed it down, and the mosh pit would, you know, pit would stop, and people would just sit there and be like, "Who the hell are these guys?" And you know, when we were introducing some of the classic music back in too, which wasn't that favorable. But then, you know, after a while, then, you know, the grunge came along, and Nirvana and Pearl Jam, and
mm-hmm.
you know, Soundgarden and Tad, and all those groups, you know. Started getting really popular, especially in the northwest corner of, you know, Seattle and Portland,
mm-hmm.
and it started coming back around. So we're like, it was kind of like reaffirming that, kind of gave a little validation that we were in the right direction. But then that group kind of disappeared too. And I started getting into just playing like slide guitar with a drummer. You know, this is back in, again, it's the early 90s. And now, you know, that did all right. We were in New York a lot. We used to go, now is the time that I was playing with my drummer who was living down in Manhattan. And we'd go and play places like Ludlow Street, Mercury Lounge, mm-hmm. place called The Cooler, The Fez, The Spiral, Continental, Brownies.
Some of these are here, some of them are not.
Yeah, some are there still. But that was a lot of fun. And mm-hmm. We were just a duo. And I played mostly, I played this big old stupid K guitar through a Marshall amp. And, mm-hmm. and my drummer would just, you know, and it was very much like what the, you know, Dan Auerbach is kind of was doing with the Black Keys and White Stripes, things like that, you know. And but, you know, we couldn't sustain that either because it was New York City and we were just getting beat up every time we tried to play a show and, you know, money-wise. And
yeah.
And it wasn't really that popular yet. And so we stopped doing that. And then all of a sudden, I found myself back up here. I guess that's when the bluegrass started. And so then I just started getting kind of bored with guitar and with banjo and really bumping and I needed to play slide too. So I've always been a frustrated guitar player, frustrated banjo player who loved to pick, strum, and play slide. And so here I am trying to write songs with all those kind of,
trying to get all those sounds,
all those parts in there. And just out of necessity, I kind of came up with this idea, this thing which is now called the Bojotar. And you know, bumping, going a little bit further down the road.
Did you name it?
Didn't name it, in fact. There I was kicking around a bunch of names. But I approached this, I went to this company, I went to a bunch of companies. I went to Deering Banjo Company, some other guitar companies. No one would listen to me. But I had a friend who was sort of an in at the Eastwood Company out of Toronto, which is a guitar company, and they liked the idea. They actually were forward-thinking enough to send me a bunch of parts, and I built a prototype, mm-hmm. which is that blue guitar right there,
mm-hmm.
which is the original Bojotar, which is basically a fusion of a resonator, which is the electric guitar, and it's got a banjo neck. But the one thing that always bummed me out about the banjo was it never had the low end that I craved. I could never finish guitar runs off bass notes. So I added a lower note to the banjo configuration. Or you could look at it like I took the sixth string guitar and took the low string off and replaced it with a fifth fret drone string, which is a high drone string. Kind of like what Keith Richards does, you know, when he took the E string off, mm-hmm. which he got, by the way, from Ry Cooder and some other people. Anyway,
all those ideas are stolen.
So yeah, all the great ideas are stolen for sure. I've never seen anything like this.
No, I saw you play, and I was very perplexed.
Well, me too. I still am perplexed. I'm learning as I go, but it's a work in progress, and I feel like a beginner again sometimes. But once I did this configuration, I felt like I was home. I was like, here we go. I could play banjo licks. I could play guitar. I can have an electric thing going on too and put the slide on it because of the resonator. Mm-hmm. And I could do all those things. And so it was like kind of a simple adjustment that I had to make to and so here we are. And the Eastwood Company was into it. And they manufactured a run of them. Of course, they didn't, you know, fly off the shelves or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I mean, I think if this thing ever did take off, someone famous would have to take it. And that's what
up.
I thought in the beginning too. I'm like, well, I'll just go around and, you know, I'll just approach all these famous people, which I did. You know, I went to Bela Fleck and he's like, wow, this is great. You know, and he goes, but I wouldn't know what to do with it.
They pick it up and they're like, I feel like a beginner again, and it's a little humbling.
Yeah. Bela Fleck picked the thing up and like melted my face off, right? He's like, oh, I couldn't play this thing. And, you know, Warren Haynes, the same thing. And David Lindley, he really liked it and said, I'm gonna buy one of these. But, you know, and then he went off his way and I went off my way. And Richard Thompson was another guy who I approached who thought it was... And everyone said it's a great idea, but I soon realized that going to very famous guitar players and banjo players or string players...
They're a little bit less willing to take risks, perhaps.
Well, I think they were all risk takers in their own way, but they already have their thing. Right. And that's why they're famous. You know, and it was Bela Fleck who had the advice to me, gave me the advice. He said, listen, man, this is a really cool instrument. This is great. But you got to make this happen.
Mm-hmm.
This, what I'm doing is I have this banjo, you know, this pre-World War I or II master tone banjo that I have perfectly set up for me. And now I'm just looking for the right microphone. That's my thing. Because he's like, I wouldn't have time for this. I could never endorse something like that. And I'm like, well, and he's like, even if you gave it to me, I'd put it in the closet with the million other things that people give me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that kind of like, that kind of hit the nail right on the head for me. I was like, oh, yeah.
It's your thing.
I got to do this. Oh, shit. And so that's what I've been kind of, now I'm kind of woodshedding. Yeah, in this thing. And that's the name of the studio here. It all comes around. The Woodshed is the name of this place. And that's what I do. I sit here and I try and figure out how to play this thing. And the thing that is wonderful about it is you could tune it so many different ways. So the world of open tunings just is blossoming for me right now. I have all these different instruments that I play in open E, open G, all you know. Any configuration you can think of. I'm finding these old Doc Boggs tunings, old time tunings, banjo tunings, but all of them are mostly geared towards five string banjo. This is a six string, and so it's not like a go
to
YouTube.
Try to figure out what to do with that.
Right, and so it's a lot of messing around and
developing the ear.
Yeah, a lot of redeveloping the ear. And you know, and at the same time writing songs. I mean, that's always a big part of it. And I don't think I'll ever be like a huge hotshot, flashy player that, you know, like a guitar banjo god, but it's a tool. It's a tool that I used to write with, and it's gotten me out of the box quite a bit. And so, yeah, I'm kind of psyched about that.
You know, that's great.
It's like I might not ever make a whole lot of money doing it or get famous, but you know, I definitely know that the stuff that I'm doing is pretty unique. And if I could just get to the place where other people get interested too, and I have. I mean,
definitely have a following. A little bit of a following.
Well, like you said, you know, like I said earlier, it's like moving up here to Vermont. There's no real scene up here.
You kind of have to move around a lot.
And I considered moving to Nashville or New York or
you have to,
or
being
LA.
an epicenter where things are happening.
Yeah, because there you have, you know, the booking agents and producers and, you know, other luthiers, other players, other writers. You know, you can go down the street and go to your local pub and there's probably a whole scene going on based around one little bar and, you know, and there's all kinds of, you know, little subcultures all over the place. Up here, it's not really like that. Everything's an hour away.
At least.
But it does allow time for, I don't know, just the...
I think headspace.
Yeah, a lot of headspace and getting things done around here, which I find us doing, you know, bread labor, as they call it, is a huge influence on that headspace that will get you into all kinds of writing. You know, I mean, I think I've written more songs building a stone wall than I have, you know, sitting in a hotel room somewhere on the road.
Yeah.
But you know, that's what works for me, I guess, at this point.
Well, let's take a halfway juncture. We're gonna turn the fan on. It's really hot in here.
that.
For those of you just tuning in, this is Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. Apparently I forgot what my show was called and what the radio station was called, but that's okay. And here with both air, talking music, life, I don't know, all the things.
Banjos, everything's stringed.
Yeah, and we just played back the recording and heard birds, so that's a special treat for you. And I would love to start talking about your songwriting, because you mentioned how you kind of picked it up and then felt like that was your thing, which I feel is common for a lot of musicians. It's just more about the words and the messages. Talk maybe a little bit about process and some of the themes that you like to write about.
Yeah. I came at the whole songwriting thing as from first being an arranger, you know, arranging with the musical aspect of a song with another lyricist. That's where I got a real foundation into things like, you know, just the structure and melody, and not so much melody but more like chords and bridges and choruses and
kind of the keys. Formula.
The foundations,
the parameters that help create songs.
And I've always dabbled in writing lyrics, but not quite successfully. It wasn't until after that Seven League Boots, that was the band I was in, we were traveling all over the place, my early 20s, that when I came back to Boston and really sat down and started writing lyrics, it was a whole different ball game. And I get my lyrics from all over the place. Mostly, I think I would say I steal them. I steal them from other, I'm inspired a lot by other musicians and writers, in movies, and all kinds of stuff. I'd say I steal it just because I feel like I'm just, really. I don't know, I'm heavily influenced by other artists, I'd say.
Sure.
But artists that are all over the road, like, of course, Dylan and Neil Young, like I mentioned earlier, but also, from things like the Holy Bible. I use a lot of biblical references.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of.
Did you grow up religious? Are you still?
Not at all, no. My folks were, I think they were like, they went to church and stuff. And because they had good coffee, and because my dad liked the
that's great.
The building.
Why else would you go to church?
My mom liked the coffee and the social aspect. My dad liked the big timber framed buildings, mm-hmm. built back in the 1700s and 1800s. So that was
true worship if I've ever heard.
Yeah. But they were always very liberal people, and they totally got it when I was like, I don't understand this at all. What do you mean?
Apparently some of those concepts either were like stuck more than you thought, or you revisited and liked because.
Well, I just didn't get the whole any of the religions. I mean, since in my adult ages, I've gone back and realized that. That all religions are kind of saying the same thing,
Mm-hmm. And yet we still don't get along. But
and we still don't get along, But I read a lot of Khalil Gibran. I just bought my book, The Prophet, for my son, who was because I really didn't give my my kids that much spiritual training, if that's what you call it.
Mm-hmm.
But we talk about it quite a bit, the Golden Rule and stuff like that applies in my life. I just don't, apply it to some sort of group or some okay. sort of God. I think there's, if you want to go there, man, we can get real deep on what I think in my philosophies and junk. But anyway, as an example, yes, the Holy Bible is in all kinds of religious texts have been a big influence.
Something melodic about some of the passages, especially Psalms and whatnot.
The latest song I wrote is about the Tower of Babel. You know, and even I did a kind of a rock opera with electric banjo on an album I did entitled Eden, which is, you know, all about, that has a lot of religious or biblical reference in it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's also, I get going back to old time music, some of the old folklores and stuff, especially around here, and also newspapers. You know, I don't read a whole lot. I don't pay a whole lot of attention to the media, but once in a while, there's something that really hits home. Like, for instance, a recent song I wrote was entitled "The Coyotes of Cape Breton."
Mm-hmm.
Now, for some reason, I overheard a conversation about this young folk singer, a girl who was 19 years old, up in Canada, who was attacked by coyotes and killed. And she was on tour up there in Cape Breton, and I was like, I overheard it. I was like, oh my God, that's awful. That's the most awful thing in the world. And so I came home and I Googled it, and sure enough, there is this young woman named Taylor Mitchell, who is a folk singer up in Canada, and she was, in fact, you know, devoured by wolves. I didn't know it at the time when I started writing this. Like, that's an incredible story, because the news, you know, as it is these days, it's a soap opera. It's like a soap opera, and I really try.
Yeah,
I'm
very sensational.
Yeah, and it's ridiculous, and I can't even really take it seriously. It's like, I don't even want to write a song about Donald Trump. You know, I
mean, no.
That's, you know, it's kind of ruined a lot of things. I used to watch the show The House of Cards. Kevin Spacey, and I was like, that was a good program until I put on a new episode. It's like, this is nothing on reality. So anyway.
So would it be safe to say that perhaps that songwriter part of your brain is basically always listening or looking for something that you grab and then
yes,
develop?
The tentacles are out for sure. The feelers are always out there. But, you know, in this particular song, it came out that was, you know, the coyotes. And not only this story was 9 years old. I didn't even realize it.
Well,
you know, I went back to check some facts or something on how she spelled her name, because she gave herself the name Taylor Mitchell. I don't even know her real name. And and I looked at the date, and I'm like, oh my God, this happened nine years ago. It's old news. But that's the thing that jumped out at me. That was the most important thing. And it's funny that, you know, it's like that old news, that one thing about, you know, it wasn't even in this country, and it's probably pretty relevant.
Yeah.
Who was thinking about that? But that is the most important. That thing just jumped out and grabbed me, and I was like, "Wow, that's real news," you know. And it also harkens back to old folklore. I mean, there's all kinds of stories about children being, you know, eaten by wolves and stuff in the woods. A lot around here.
Definitely an archetype, predatory animals.
And then it brought me to like some of these old, like the old time stuff, like Doc Boggs, and I just did a record in tribute to Doc Boggs.
Yeah, that's your latest album.
Yeah, and you know, one of the songs I covered was a song called Cole Younger, which is about an outlaw who rode with the James Gang and all this stuff, and back in the 1800s, and that came directly from a newspaper back when the news was written as poetry almost. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, and some of these outlaws were glorified in the papers, you know, in this very eloquent prose, you
mm-hmm.
know. It was people, like, took some time to write it out and really gave it a lot of thought rather than just, like, sensationalism
and
regurgitating
and
crap. And so, you know, that's... Right now, that's where my writing is kind of this gothic Americana kind of thing.
Mm. Well, talk about maybe. I mean, you definitely don't have any songs about Trump, but from listening to your music, I do feel like there is sometimes a political flavor.
Yeah,
and especially with, I think you have a song about the pipeline.
That's a recent one too. Yeah, about the, it's called Ogallala, which is about the aquifer under most of the Midwest, goes
mm-hmm.
from North Dakota down to Texas, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's drying up at a you know, this a scary rate. We're about to lose it. It's the biggest aquifer in our country. It's where we get all our water for our crops and all kinds of, you know. And it's scary. It's going away, and it's going to be gone, and it's going to be real.
And then what?
And then what? Exactly. A lot of my songs these days, most of them, I think, have some sort of underlying environmental statement, for sure. I mean, even some of the ones that appear to be kind of just like even outlaw songs or a love song or whatever,
byproduct.
It's coming from it. You could equally line that up with us destroying Mother Nature in a way, and that's a very huge and ongoing theme that I don't really see going away, because that's one of the things I think I got from living up here in Vermont.
That's what I was gonna say. I'm sure shaped by your life trajectory and your identity, moving out here 30 years ago rather than to
yeah.
a musical
well, it's only,
epicenter.
It was only 20 years ago.
20 years ago.
Not that old yet.
Oh.
Woo! But anyway, 20 years is enough to be sitting, you know, sitting here and looking out the window and noticing.
To care.
Yeah, and just noticing the change of the season being. I mean, up here in Vermont, there, and you know, anywhere rural, I suppose, in New England, you really have to be prepared at all times, because it's always the next season you're getting prepared for. I'm putting up wood for the winter right now, and you know, it's something that's always has been here and will always and it will continue. I mean, You really have to prepare. You there's no dull moment. There's no time to be idle.
You're so connected to it, too.
And yes, that's another thing. Having dirt and rocks and grass under your feet is, and also in a way we're kind of like in a bubble up here, because we're not caught up in a lot of stuff that goes on down, you know, in the metropolitan districts. I guess, you know, I don't want to sound like a total redneck or anything like that, or. We're like a Thoreau. I mean, yeah.
Well,
we're sitting here on a computer.
Cities are actually incredibly environmentally friendly, you know.
They are. So. And yeah, it's true. And there's a whole different aspect to that. I mean, I go down there and I see all this, you know, roof gardens and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the technology that is just going so, so quickly, I can't even keep up. But it's fascinating. I mean, it's just different. I'm not saying living up here in...
It's different, and it's
rural is better. I'm not saying that at all. I mean,
it's better for some.
It's
not
better
for all.
Me. I wouldn't be able to keep up. I think my head is already crowded with so much chatter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
Been recently diagnosed with the ADD. You know, and it's like,
oh,
yeah,
you were diagnosed.
Yeah, about 5 years ago.
Has that changed the way you see yourself interact?
Well,
with?
I now I'm sort of aware of it, so I don't have to get as frustrated, and kind of can use that.
Yeah, sometimes
use those voices screaming in my head at all hours of the night. You know,
yeah,
that I could utilize that.
I think sometimes just like being able to give something a name or understanding what's happening kind of creates.
Yeah, a lot of people say, "Well, that's just a bunch of bullshit." That's just, you know, it's like maybe that's true. I just think it's a title they give to people who can't really keep up with technology, and
yeah,
at least that's what it is in
case. And I think the segue of coming from, I mean, I'm on the end curve of this, definitely, but coming from a world that was very analog to a world that now is very digital,
yeah,
I think sometimes I definitely, you know, turn things off as much as possible, and just to like, okay, let me like reset everything.
Exactly. Oh, man.
And definitely
it's
hiking is nice.
Yeah, like I said, like building stone walls, doing carpentry projects, gardening,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
you know, flipping the compost pile, or you know.
Well, and that's a creative tool for all creatives. You know, if you're stuck, go move, go make something, go like do something physical.
Because you know, and I've been told, you know, time and time again by friends and fellow musicians or people who in the business is like, dude, you got to stay up. You got to tweet.
No,
you
got to
get on Instagram. You got to get on Facebook. You
got
to get on all this stuff. And it's like, I can't. I can't keep up with it. It's distracting. It's super distracting. I'd rather be
as
up
I
here
pull,
writing
pull
something
things on my phone. So I do want to talk. I end with a series of rapid fire questions. So we'll go there in a moment. I do want to talk. Do you have 21 albums out right now? Is that the right number?
You know, I don't even
you
remember.
Have a number. Of
I have
albums.
A bunch of records. Some of them were with groups.
Your latest is a tribute.
The latest is the tribute to Doc Boggs and Mississippi Fred McDowell.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of tied in to the whole Bogitar business there, because Doc Boggs was the banjo picker.
Mm-hmm.
Fred McDowell is a bottleneck slide player. So I wanted to kind of utilize the instrument that I'm writing on and playing with and learn, you know, going forward with these two old time players who are banjo and slide player. So it kind of ties into that. As well as like the writing aspect of where, you know, the songs they sang came from, again with the American kind of gothic
mm-hmm.
themes,
yeah.
old murder ballads and stuff like that.
It's fantastic.
and I also have a couple of original songs on there as well that
mm-hmm.
were influenced by, you know, probably the same things that they were influenced by, I think. And also these two people, they were never celebrities in their time. They're rounders, you know. They lived in rural places, and they went from town to town and got, you know, a little bit of cash for playing live shows, just like I do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I felt kind of a kinship to that aspect of
their life
as well.
It's
so
like parallel to yours.
Yeah, but right now I'm working on. Jeez, there's so much stuff. I got so many projects. I've just finished a project where I've completed a synth banjo. We won't go there yet. Well, that's
let me talk. I'm sure every one of your albums has a story, and unfortunately, we'd have to do probably a whole other episode.
There's a lot.
But
there's
a
lot of stuff to go through.
What was you handed me a stack of CDs, which was I listened to, and they're really great. I love the one you made in Belize.
Oh yeah.
And then I'm trying to recall the name of the other one. I think it was the one you made right before. It wasn't the orange cover. It was the other one.
Well, I did one with Levon Helm.
Okay.
And that's kind of the one that pays some of the bills around here.
Mm-hmm.
Levon Helm, everyone knows who he is. If you don't, he's was a very famous drummer for the band, Bob Dylan, the band, iconic drummer, moved to this, I could go on and
uh-huh.
on. But anyway, I was lucky enough to make a record with him, and that if anyone has ever heard of me out of there, it's because of him.
Mm-hmm.
But getting back to the Belize thing, that's interesting you brought that up, because that was an album where I actually went and did a lot of it's like free writing, and where I wrote lyrics before I put them to music. A lot of those were poems, you know, just kind of like from free writing,
mm-hmm.
poetry stories, whatever, and they started out as words rather than music. And that's one of the few exceptions.
And quite the collaboration, too. A lot of people came in on...
Yeah, I allowed a lot of my friends to come and play on it. I went out there with a ukulele, and
mm-hmm.
I know you're getting into ukulele.
Yes, I just
and
started.
This thing, I had a little Rezzo ukulele that I brought with me,
uh-huh.
you know, out to this, you know, remote atoll in Belize. It's 50 miles out in the ocean. And
how did you end up there? Just
exploring? I wanted to go someplace that was, you know, I was getting a little burnt on Vermont, actually, and wanted to go someplace completely different. And not only did we want to go down Central America, but we wanted to go underwater. So I did a lot of scuba diving down there and snorkeling on the Barrier Reef, which really changes your perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So I come out, you know, in the evenings, pick up the ukulele, and I brought with me, and there's no electricity or running water or anything out there.
Mm-hmm.
You have to bring everything with you. So I brought a little Sony Discman and a handful of batteries and recorded all this stuff. And to make a long story short, I brought it back here to Vermont and had some friends of mine just come and add some parts to it.
Embellish.
But I only, to keep it fresh, they were able to, I allowed them to listen to it once, the track once. Here's like, here's the song, listen to it. Okay, here, you know,
and let's go.
There's the key. It's in B flat.
You wanted to keep a lot of more improvisational feel.
Yeah,
and
it was all pretty much improv, and there was a little bit of editing, just to, you know, and so then they went for it. And there was even a couple times where I remember the bass player, my good friend Jeremy's Curtis was just on the upright bass and he just stopped and he's like, what the hell is going on here? What is this song about? And I'm like, hey, there you go. I guess we gotta, I guess that's where the bass stops on this song. And it did, you know? And I had someone else come back in and pick it up on like a piano or something like that, and the bass notes.
I'll have to listen again and see if I can find
it. Yeah, I think it was the song In Between the Keys. Because the song came out in between two keys, like the key of like E and E flat or something. It was like, and right in between.
It got confusing, apparently.
It got really confusing. He's playing it on a fretless instrument. But it was written, you know,
that reminds
in Nissan Tull, so there's keys there, so it kind of like, oh, yeah.
Reminds me of one more question I have. We mentioned maybe bringing in your current bassist.
Al?
And you were like, but he wouldn't say anything. He'd just sit in the corner and we'd ask him questions and he would not respond.
Unlike me, Al is not a talker.
which makes me curious about what rehearsal or practice space is like for you guys.
Oh, it's wonderful. It is. I love working with Al. He's half my age and he's in his young 20s and he's got youth on his side, he's got energy and a whole lot of talent, and he is a dude that listens more than he speaks,
which is
awesome. And you know, and I'm kind of the opposite, so it's a good little relationship. And yeah, I wish he was here, because then we'd play some stuff for you.
Yeah, I'll have to throw on some songs from one of your albums.
But
so.
This is a recent thing. That the first album was Sundowser, and that is the first album. It's the first time he ever was in the studio ever.
Mm-hmm.
And
how did you guys connect?
We
music scene somehow.
Yeah, just I've again with the feelers. You know, out here in Vermont, there's not a whole,
you're like you.
There's not a lot of people. I mean, you could go to Burlington, but there's it's. You tend to figure out where
and
the musicians
things move
are.
Slower. Yeah, your circles overlap a little bit.
Yeah, so yeah, I just found them. I forget exactly. I think I went to an open mic. Someone said you should meet this dude, and I did. And I was like, yeah. He was green as they could be. Plucked him right out of the manure there. Brought him down here and whipped him into shape.
Slowly but
and now he's just badass. Bass player, and he's starting to sing too, and he's got such a great voice, and I can tell he's got an old soul, so it's working out pretty good.
Nice. Well, moving into Rapid Fire. So
all right, Rapid Fire.
Ink and Worm is a show about books, so my first question for you is, are there any books that stand out in your childhood or maybe adolescence, things that influenced you, that your parents read to you?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, what was the first book that was... I mean, a lot of the Dr. Seuss stuff. My parents were big in Dr. Seuss. Where the Wild Things Are.
Mm,
of course.
So good.
And then, in high school, I remember some of the books that stood out that I really loved were... One was called The Man with the Golden Arm by Nelson Algren.
Interesting.
Huxley's Brave New World.
Oh, yes.
And then some of the great stuff, like, Great Expectations, what we had to read, and, of course, what are some of the other ones that really, I don't know, Secret Garden, I remember that one, that was pretty cool, and then getting it, and then I love this stuff, the satire of, not Catch 22, but Slaughterhouse.
Oh, Vonnegut.
Kurt Vonnegut was a big.
I just read my first
Welcome
Vonnegut
to Monkey House,
book this year.
Yeah?
Yeah, I hadn't read him before now, so I liked it. We read Man Without a Country, which was very disturbing, resonant with our current political climate.
Yes.
But,
scary how that kind of.
A lot of holding of my breath, and then I have to remember to breathe. Let me ask you, I've been curious lately how people listen to their music, part of that switch from, actually having a thing versus being able to look something up online. So how do you
listen to music?
Yeah.
That's a good question because I'm in transition. I still have CDs that are scattered like all over my car and all over the place, and I still put those
as
in.
CDs become.
Because yeah, as they become more and more obsolete. But you know, I do have an iPhone with iMusic, and you know, I download stuff when I can. But you know, the iMusic is hard. You know, I don't have cell service here.
iTunes, yeah.
And so, but we are able to. You know, I could load up my phone and so that's what I'm doing right now. And it's really, you know, I sit here and be like, what a pain in the ass it is to listen to music these days, which it is. But it having like Apple Music, I gotta say, I could just dial up. You know, I've learned, I've found so many people who
forgot about,
but Young's like who would have slipped through the cracks otherwise, you know, who I never would have heard of.
Okay, so you're constantly pulling in new music, which
I don't like, unlike my wife who has like playlists of the music she loves and she holds it dear to her and she revisits it like all the time. It's the same, a lot of it's the same stuff. I'm not like that at all. I'm constantly looking for new stuff. Been listening to a lot of like, you know, Flying Lotus, Thundercat stuff lately, like that.
Interesting.
Yeah, which I'm really digging, and
I'm sure I.
And a lot, but Peter Gunn is another guy who I've really embraced. Some of the jazz stuff. Kamasi Washington, I think his name is the guy who did big, huge jazz album just came out in the last few years that. Will take years for me to figure out.
You know? As most jazz,
yeah, but
complex.
But also, you know, I don't know. Yeah, I'm just always looking, always looking.
Nice. Next question: do you have a brag? So for like, set the scene. You're at a party. People are like, "Oh yes, I climbed Mount Everest 3 times or whatever." What's the brag?
What's
that you pull
my
out?
Brag? That's a good one. Making a record with Levon Helm is actually
that's
that was a good one because that happened so organically. It's you know, I could say that's a brush with fame, but it wasn't. It was more like just a very organic relationship, you know. That but that was
and create things.
Yeah, and you know, and yeah. I'd say that was probably.
Do you watch much? You like you mentioned House of Cards. So do you have current?
I have my stories.
Streaming addiction. What's your current?
I'm an insomniac. I only sleep about 3 or 4 hours a night.
Ah, that's so many creatives. I love sleep.
I wish I could sleep. Oh God, and I don't like to take drugs to go to sleep. So
that's fair.
I find myself, you know, I do. I think right now there's some wonderful. Stories that are in. I love the series thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've always liked movies,
mm-hmm.
but the series thing is really cool right now. I think it's great for storytelling. I think it's great for cinematography. I think it's great for music
and some really amazing,
great
stuff.
Like I mean, yeah, of course, I'm into the Game of Thrones. It's a guilty pleasure.
It's so good.
and a friend of mine actually was a writer for The Expanse. Which I'm also digging. It's a sci-fi show.
I haven't heard of it.
And you know, I've watched The Leftovers, and the silly things like the Silicon Valley. I think it's funny. But I spend a lot of time, going through those, watching these shows. You know,
This is just a follow-up question. Any cartoons? I'm just curious because that's been.
I started watching Archer, but of course, The Simpsons is a huge impact on because they've just been at it so long. And I really do believe that when, you know, our civilization, you know, goes away, you know, a million years from now,
they're going to find The Simpsons.
They're
going to
find
The
Simpsons.
That's how they live.
That is the best. The Simpsons is the best social commentary of our lifetime, I think.
And then,
it really is.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not just joking around.
No, because there's the cultural references that are, you know, throwback references and then the current references and then just like family structures.
Pretty accurate. And it's funny as hell. I mean, the
pretty good encapsulation. Yeah, definitely. So returning to books, I walked into your house and I oddly didn't notice books. Are there books
books everywhere. You're inundated by books. We're trying to get rid of them.
I wasn't looking at the books. I was looking at the dogs.
We have lots of books there and a lot of them are our books, like on like timber framings, gardening, stonework,
the projects.
The projects, you know. But and also the philosophy. The book I'm just finished was a book by William Copperthwaite, who is Copperthwaite. It's hard to say. he's kind of like from the Scott and Helen Nearing. I don't know if you know who they are. They were kind of like the back of the Landers in Vermont.
It sounds familiar, but I don't know.
Back in the 50s and 60s. This Bill was Copperthwaite was more in the 70s. Up in Maine, you know, just very simple living, made everything, made his own stuff, made his own tools,
kind
his
of
own
like
clothes.
Off-grid and like independent, self-sustaining.
Yeah, completely. And so that is it's called, the book was called A Handmade Life. I just finished that the other night.
Recommend?
I would, but I would only recommend it to anyone who's looking for some sort of social alternative or who would be interested in you know, kind of homesteading kind of thing, which I am. I'm very much into that stuff. And, you know, I'm also read a lot by, not like real self-help, but, you know, like Carolyn Miss, I think is fascinating.
Ooh, I love Carolyn Miss. She's very readable. It's accessible.
It's not fluffy new age stuff at all.
I really appreciate her perspective. And she has such great storytelling skills, too. So thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah,
that's
well,
the first time she's come up.
There's another one that, who wrote The Alchemist?
Coelho. Yeah, Coelho.
I've read most of his stuff.
Me too. I had a streak.
Yeah. I mean, it's adventure. It's like, it's venture spiritualism.
Yeah.
I don't know what you call
it's
it.
It's not,
but,
yeah.
You know, and what else? You know, and then there's the heavy stuff too. That you know, like I love the writers like Huxley and stuff like that.
Yeah, more.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But a lot of books. I mean, it's all over the place.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank
you
for giving me wine and helping me record this. And couple things. If you like what you hear on Radio Free Brooklyn, please check us out. Consider donating. $1 a month is $12 a year. That's like 2 coffees, 1 cocktail, but it really does help out. And then my other hope is that you'll leave a review wherever you're listening to this, that what you like, what you hate. And I'll leave you with a word, take it or leave it. Murah. Ta-da!